I had something of a hard time deciding what to talk about, and I actually prepared two talks, of which I will present you the one on infinite chaosymmetry in four dimensions, but I'd be happy to discuss in private about my other work on Higgs branch localization. So the work I will present is about infinite chaosymmetry in four dimensions, which is based on work I've done in collaboration with Chris Bee, Maralina de Moche, Pedro Allendo, Leonardo Rastelli, and Balthazar Reis about 9 months ago. And also on some recent work that appeared a couple of weeks ago with Chris Bean, Leonardo Rastelli, and Balthazar Reis, and some upcoming work that should appear soon. So recently, many models have been discovered which feature extended superconformal symmetry, but although they combine two powerful symmetries, namely supersymmetry and conformal symmetry, somehow when they are studied, it's mainly the supersymmetry that is being used. So, for example, supersymmetric localization techniques allow you to compute exactly the partition function and vacuum expectation values of supersymmetric operators in Lagrangian theories, which admittedly are somewhat rare in the class of superconformal field theories I will be studying. And for example, another favorite tool of ours is Cyber-Guitton theory to study the low energy effective action in certain Coulomb vacua. But somehow these approaches do not fully leverage the most prominent tools that are available to us in conformal field theories, namely the fact that it has a convergent operator product expansion and the fact that it's conformal data, namely its spectrum of operators and its three-point functions, are tightly constrained by the conformal bootstrap equations, which tell us that any four-point function should be crossing symmetric. Perhaps the reason that people don't really pay attention to the conformal part of these theories is that obtaining exact results using a bootstrap program seem to fall short beyond certain classes of two-dimensional theories. But the natural question, of course, is to ask, does supersymmetry actually improve this situation? And that is indeed exactly the kind of question I would like to ask. More in particular, I would like to ask if the conformal bootstrap equations admit an exactly solvable truncation in the case of four-dimensional theories with extended supersymmetry. And it will turn out that the answer is yes, and it takes a particular form of a map which maps any four-dimensional n equals two superconformal field theory, modulo its marginal deformations, into a two-dimensional chiral algebra. And this latter has a manifestly solvable bootstrap program. So once we have this map in place, we can immediately start reaping the benefits, since the chiral algebra I will show you throughout the talk contains and organizes an infinite amount of protected four-dimensional conformal data. Moreover, it describes the contributions of short multiples in the OOP expansion of four-dimensional correlators, which is actually a particular example of the fact that it fixes, in particular, three-point couplings in the conformal data over there. And moreover, we can derive powerful new unitarity bounds just by the fact that we have this exactly solvable program in two dimensions. On the other hand, we can also exploit the fact that we have this map to explore new interesting two-dimensional chiral algebras. And moreover, we can organize two-dimensional chiral algebras, at least a certain set of them, as a generalized topological quantum field theory that takes values in chiral algebras. This structure will follow from the class S structure in four-dimensional theories. So let me briefly sketch the outline of my talk. I will start by explaining how this 2D, 4D correspondence comes about. Then I will move on to deriving the unitarity bounds I just mentioned. I will continue by giving a particularly nice example and some more results on chiral algebras that one can obtain by exploiting the map chi I just showed you. And I will finish by talking about chiral algebras of class S, which are the chiral algebras associated to four-dimensional theories of class S. And finally, I will finish by some interesting future directions. So let's start by considering an n equals two superconformal field theory, and in particular, its supersymmetry algebra is known to be SU2,2/2, whose bosonic subgroup is, of course, the conformal group in four dimensions, plus the SU2R symmetry plus a U1R piece. Then, without any a priori good reason, I decide to restrict myself to a two-dimensional plane, R2 inside R4, which I will call the chiral algebra plane, and which I will parameterize by the usual complex coordinates z and z bar. Now, I want to study the conformal subgroup, the subgroup of the conformal group, which keeps this plane fixed. And that is, of course, the usual SL2, which acts as Möbius transformations on z, SL2 bar, which acts as Möbius transformations on z bar, and the rotations in the orthogonal plane. And then the main claim of this entire 2D40 correspondence is the observation that there exist nilpotent supercharges, which I denote Q1 and Q2, inside this algebra SU2,2/2, which are such that, on the one hand, the SL2 transformations on the plane are Q-closed, and on the other hand, the diagonal combination of the SL2 bar and the complexified SU2R is Q-exact. This diagonal combination I will call SL2 hat from now on. So the point being now of that I will restrict myself to the cohomology of these nilpotent supercharges. And the first statement that one makes when studying this cohomology is that operators necessarily lie in the chiral algebra plane if they want to lie in the cohomology. So restricting to operators which lie over there, I will start by studying how they look like in the origin, how I can characterize these operators at the origin. And at the origin, it's quite straightforward to figure out that they must be annihilated by these particular two supercharges and their conjugates, or equivalently, and even more simply, they have to satisfy this chirality condition, where we have the four-dimensional conformal dimension minus the sum of the Lorentz spins divided by 2 minus the SU2R charge should be 0. Actually, four-dimensional unitarity implies that if this equation holds, then immediately the U and R charge plus the difference of the Lorentz spin should also be 0. So this is a clean characterization of operators which sit in the cohomology at the origin of the chiral algebra plane. And in fact, we can say one more thing, namely that they necessarily lie in the highest weight state of SU2R. The reasoning being that if they would not be in the highest weight state, then I could act with a raising operator, and then this quantity would become negative, but unitarity forbids it from being negative. So this is the characterization of the operator at the plane. And now I want to go on and consider how they look like when I move away from the origin. So I showed you that the SL2 subgroup of the conformal group that acts as Möbius transformation on Z was Q-closed. So that seems like a good action to use to move away from the origin. But the SL2 bar piece of the subgroup of conformal group was not Q-closed or Q-exact. It's only diagonal combination of this SL2 bar and complexified SL2R. So in particular, it seems like a good idea to use the L hat minus one operators that sit in that diagonal combination. So if I indeed then take some operator which transforms in the spin K over 2 representation of SU2R and consider its highest weight state, which I want to be a sure operator, by which I mean that it's an operator which at the origin lies in my cohomology, then I can translate it around on the plane by acting with on left and right hand side by the exponentiated translation. And I will find that the Z translation is the usual translation, but the Z bar translation mixes in lowering operations of on the SU2R quantum numbers. So when we move away from the plane in the Z bar direction, I will necessarily have to mix in certain lowered components of the operator I'm started off with. So the 1-1-1 will be mixed with 1-1-1-2 and 2s everywhere eventually. And explicitly by integrating this action, I can actually find that the explicit result reads as follows, where U is a certain SU2R doublet, which explicitly depends on Z bar in the following way. So if I do this kind of translations, I know I will remain in cohomology. And in fact, because the Z bar dependence was obtained by a Q exact operation, I know that in the cohomology, actually, this operator will only depend on Z. The Z bar dependence was Q exact, so it drops out. Now, it is a straightforward exercise to verify that if I have such operators, that if I compute their operator product expansion, it will be meromorphic in Z up to Q exact terms. And the conformal weight of the operator will be given by the L naught weight which is explicitly given over here. So now I have a complete characterization of the cohomology, and let's do a first example of how this works. I will study the very simplest n equals 2 subconformal field theory I can think of, namely the free hypermultiplet. So let me first remind everyone that the free hypermultiplet contains the scalars Q and Q tilde, and their conjugate trees can be organized according to SU2R doublets and SU2 flavor doublets in a matrix form like over here, where SU2R flips to rows, SU2F flips to columns, and which have an OPE given as follows. Now, the first step in the program I just outlined is to figure out what are the Schur operators. What are the operators at the origin which lie in the cohomology? And for the particular case of the free hypermultiplet, that is exactly the SU2R highest weight states of the scalars in the hypermultiplet. Once I figured that out, I can start translating them in my Q-closed and Q-exact way. And as I said, I will, when I move away from the origin in the z-bar direction, mix in certain lowering components. And explicitly, I will find at the origin the highest weight state, but away from it, a z-bar dependent lowered component. Now, given this operator, I can go on and compute this OPE. And indeed, when I compute it using as an input this expression, I will find a z-dependent result. And in fact, this is a little bit too simple an example, but because in general, I would expect there to be also z-bar dependent stuff, which, however, would be q-exact. So as a result of the free hypermultiplet, I seem to find a pair of symplectic bosons, which is non-unitary, as can be seen immediately by looking at its two-dimensional stress tensor, which has central charge -1. And in fact, the flavor symmetry of the model gives rise to a flavor current, which is actually an affine current, which has level -0.5. Now, these two values, they will turn out to be just one instance of a more general feature, which I will come to in the next slide. So in the very same spirit, we can look at any supermultiplet in an n equals 2 superconformal field theory and just study which operators are Schur operators, twist translate them on the plane, and figure out what does it mean in the 2D chiral algebra. So the first item in this dictionary I already explained on the previous slide. The next item, the free vector multiplet, gives rise to a small BC ghost system of dimension 1,0, where by small, I have in mind that the C0 mode is removed from the theory. Then if my four-dimensional theory happens to have a flavor symmetry group G, then of course I expect the theory to have a flavor symmetry current. That flavor symmetry current will sit in a supermultiplet whose bottom component is what people call the moment map. The moment map operator lives, of course, in the adjoint of the flavor symmetry because it sits in the same multiplet as the flavor symmetry current. And it also sits in the adjoint of the SU2R. The Schur operator in the multiplet will be exactly the highest weight state of this moment map. And if I twist and translate it on the plane, I will end up with a dimension 1 field, which turns out to have exactly the OPE of an affine current at level K2D, which is related to the flavor central charge in four dimensions via a relation involving a factor -0.5. So just to remind everyone, the flavor central charge is just the normalization of the two-point coupling of flavor symmetry currents. Similarly, I know that my four-dimensional theory will have a stress tensor, and that stress tensor sits in a multiplet which also contains the SU2R current. And again, it turns out that the highest weight component of the SU2R current, if you restrict yourself to the plus-plus dot components, is a Schur operator. I twist and translate it on the plane, and I end up with a dimension 2 chiral operator in my chiral algebra, which happens to have the OPE and all the properties of a stress tensor. So I find an Virasoro enhancement of my global SL2 symmetry. And moreover, I can identify the two-dimensional central charge C to be given by -12, the four-dimensional central charge. So our theories will necessarily be non-unitary because they have negative central charge. A final item on this dictionary would be the fact that any Higgs branch chiral ring generator will turn into a Virasoro primary generator of my chiral algebra. and moreover, chiral ring relations, which encode the geometry of the Higgs branch, are in direct relation to null relations of the chiral algebra. So we find this nice interplay where the geometry of the Higgs branch translates into some algebraic null relations in the chiral algebra. Now, the dictionary I presented so far cannot be complete before we know how to perform exactly marginal gauging. So in the four-dimensional theory, if I start with some theory T, which has a favor symmetry G of level K4D is 4 times the dual Coxeter number, then if I introduce a vector multiplet, I will be able to perform an exact marginal gauging, exactly because this condition is equivalent to the statement that the beta function will be 0. So the salient steps in performing an exactly marginal gauging in 4 dimensions is that at the 0 coupling, I just introduce my vector multiplet and I restrict myself to gauge invariant states. And then when I move away from 0 coupling, then certain short multiplets in the theory, they will start recombining into long multiplets and acquire anomalous dimensions. And the Schur operators, or in their twisted translated friends, they are exactly such short multiplets. So we might need to figure out how to remove short multiplets that can recombine in the chiral algebra. So indeed, what is the chiral algebra analog of this story? Well, at step one, at zero gauge coupling, I would like to introduce an adjoint ghost system, since the ghost system was exactly related to the vector multiplet, and I restrict myself to gauge invariant states. And then at step two, it turns out that this recombination story can be elegantly captured by a BRST procedure. And the BRST procedure, of course, involves BRST current, which turns out to be exactly nilpotent if this condition holds. So beta function being 0 in 4 dimensions relates to the BRST current in the chiral algebra to be nilpotent. And this BRST procedure, as I said, it captures precisely the one-loop corrections to the supercharges, which determine whether, whether certain operators are Schur operators or not. So let me give some more comments on this gauging, because they will turn out to be important later on. Namely, we can show that the OPE coefficients of my chiral algebra are involved in a non-renormization theory, which is proved by these people. And as a consequence of this non-renormization theorem, I know that the chiral algebra will turn out to be not depending on exactly marginal couplings. It's a very important statement, which we'll come back later when I talk about class S theories. In fact, the same gauging procedure as just explained, namely this BRST procedure, also shows up when you study gauged Wessel-Meine-Witten models via some path integral manipulations. And this leads us to the slogan that 4D gauging is equal to 2D gauging. And it would be very interesting to understand if this statement can be understood by some kind of localization argument. A final item I would like to mention is that the superconformal index, which can be thought of as some analog of the Witten index for the radially quantized theory, can be reinterpreted in the chiral algebra in a particularly nice way. So let me first remind you what the Schur limit of the superconformal index is. It is defined as the trace over the Hilbert space of states on the 3-sphere of -1 to the fermion number, and further refined by certain fugacities, namely a fugacity Q that couples to the difference of the conformal dimension and the SE2R charge, and fugacities that couple to flavor symmetries. This Schur index, as I mentioned before, exactly captures states that are annihilated by these superchargers and their conjugates. So that is why I started calling my operators Schur operators. At the origin, the operators are indeed also precisely killed by these superchargers. And in fact, we can rewrite this combination E minus R using the chirality condition I showed you earlier. So using this condition over here, I can rewrite E minus R as E plus J1 plus J2 over 2, which one can recognize as being exactly the eigenvalue of L naught. So I can rewrite the Schur index over here as a graded partition function of my chiral algebra. So it is not an index in the chiral algebra, because chiral algebras are in general not supersymmetric, but it is a greater partition function, which happens to be equal to the Schur index. So let me now move on to discussing unitarity bounds, which can be derived from this chiral algebra perspective. So I told you that the twisted translated version of the moment map operator in cohomology is precisely an affine current. Now, the four-point function of affine currents is completely determined once I tell you at which affine level they live. Once I tell you K2D, I can write down the four-point function, and it will be some explicitly known function of the two-dimensional conformal cross ratio and this two-dimensional level K2D. This expression, it depends on, well, four adjoint indices, the four indices of my four currents over here, but it can be decomposed using certain projection operators into the exchanged symmetry channels. So I take two point function here, I exchange a certain representation R in the middle, and I go back to the two adjoint indices. And precisely these functions, they can be decomposed in SL2 conformal blocks. And as a result, I find an expression which depends on coefficients A. These coefficients A, again, are completely fixed once I tell you what the two-dimensional affine level is. So this is nice. This is all in chiral algebra. I have complete control of what's going on. So let's now move on to the analogous situation in four dimensions. So in four dimensions, I would like to consider the four-point function of moment map operators. And actually, it is a well-known trick that you can soak up the SU2R indices by contracting it with exactly the same function U, which I've been using all along, but now not depending on Z bar, but just some generic variable Y. So we trade SU2R indices for some generic variable Y. And then this combination I can subject to the four-point function. And I will find, as a result of the four-point function, again, some projection along the exchange symmetry of some function which I do not know. Of course, in four dimensions, we should not hope to know four-point functions on the nose. But this expression, in which I used Z and Z bar instead of the usual four-dimensional conformal cross ratios U and V, this expression can be decomposed in superconformal blocks. And in fact, I can decompose it according to short and long multiplets being exchanged in the four-point function. And now the statement I would like to make is that this short piece is exactly captured by the chiral algebra. So more precisely, these coefficients P, which appear here, are completely determined as soon as I give you the coefficients A over here. At least they are completely determined as soon as I make the assumption that there are no higher spin currents in my theory, which is a good assumption if my theory is interacting. So I have these P's completely determined in terms of the A's, but I know actually more about these P's. These P's have to be positive. Four-dimensional unitarity demands these coefficients to be positive because, after all, they're just the three-point function squared. So, and this positivity is not automatic if I rewrite them in terms of the coefficients A of the previous slide. And it's exactly this notion that will lead to the unitarity bounds. I will impose that the solutions of these coefficients P in terms of A's are positive. And then I find, for example, in the exchanged singlet channel, the bound true for any four-dimensional n equals 2 superconformal field theory, if it has some flavor symmetry, namely that the dimension of that flavor symmetry group divided by the four-dimensional central charge is larger than or equal to 24 times the dual Coxeter number divided by the four-dimensional flavor central charge minus 12. So this is universally true. And in fact, we can say a little bit more. We can say what happens if the inequality is saturated. In that case, that means that four-dimensional theory has a certain Higgs branch relation, namely that the moment map squared in the singlet channel, in the singlet, has to be zero. So this is one example of what I mentioned earlier, that Higgs branch relations show up in this work. And in particular, they are related to certain null relations in the chiral algebra. And in this particular case, the null relation I have is the relation that the two-dimensional stress tensor T actually equals the Sugawara stress tensor of the current algebra, which is associated to the flavor symmetry of my theory. Similarly, I can look at different exchange channels. I can look at any representation R appearing here, and then I find certain different bounds on the four-dimensional flavor central charge, and the meaning of those, if they are saturated in four dimensions, is again that there are certain Higgs branch relations which have to hold true, and in the chiral algebra, it is a null relation which exists. So the bounds are as follows. There are bounds on for the flavor central charge, as I said. They follow from looking at the exchange representations listed here, and they're valid for the groups which are given over here. So these are universally true as soon as I assume that no higher spin currents are present. Now, a particularly nice example an application of these unitarity bounds is as follows. Suppose I'm interested in n equals 2 superconformal field theories, which have as their Higgs branch the one instanton moduli space of GF instantons. Then I know, because this moduli space has to satisfy the so-called Joseph relations, which state that moment map squared in representation I2, which is defined by looking at symmetric product of two adjoints up to the representation which has as its Dynkin labels those given by twice. The Dynkin labels are twice those of the adjoint. So if I look at all representations appearing in the symmetric product except for this one, then I know that there have to be Higgs branch relations which set to zero the moment map squared in those representations. Okay, so is this possibly realized in any known theories? And the answer is yes. If I look at superconformal field theories which arise from a single D3 brain probing an F-theory singularity, then I know that these kind of relations are satisfied for the gauge groups A1, A2, D4, E67, E8. So if I look at particular F-theory singularities, the gauge theory I'm looking or describing then precisely has as its Higgs branch the one instanton moduli space. And through this reasoning that Higgs branch relations can only exist if certain unitarity bounds are saturated, I can recompute their central charges easily from the list over here and from the generic singlet relation over here. In fact, we can do more. We can figure out if there might perhaps be other theories out there which have as their Higgs branch the one instant moduli space, and then they should allow for these relations to be true. And in fact, there are two more possibilities which one can conceivably think of, namely G2 and F4. And because we know that these relations have to be true, we can immediately predict which central charges this theory should have. I must say, these theories have not been found, but, well, if they do exist, these are the central charges. Let me now present a first example and some additional results of chiral algebras which follow from 4D theories. So I will start by looking at SU2 superconformal QCD. It's probably the simplest non-trivial example. And in fact, I know this theory has enhanced flavor symmetry because, well, the 2 of SU2 is pseudo-real. So I have this SO8 flavor symmetry, and in fact, it is exactly one of these theories which have as their Higgs branch the one instanton moduli space of SO8 instantons. So I know that in the chiral algebra, I must find an SO8 current algebra at level minus 2. I must be able to identify the stress tensor with the Sugawara stress tensor because the singlet bound has to be satisfied. So as I said over here, if I saturate this bound, then the stress tensor must be equal to the Sugawara stress tensor. And moreover, I know that there should be additional null relations in my chiral algebra which capture the rest of the Joseph relations. So the question one would like to answer now is this current algebra, the entire chiral algebra, associated to n equals 2 SU2 superconformal QCD or not? Well, we answered this question by performing various checks. The first check we performed is we took the theory of 8-3-half hypermultiplets twice. We glued it together using the BRST procedure I explained earlier. And we just explicitly computed cohomology level by level up to dimension 5, and we found that nothing else appeared. That's already a good check. not really a check, but more like a sanity check of the entire program we have, is that indeed Joseph relations are satisfied. One can check explicitly that this current algebra has the right nulls in it. Moreover, one can check that the Schur index is exactly equal to the vacuum character of this affine current algebra, which is actually a non-trivial check because, well, it's non-trivial to compute these vacuum characters because they're sitting at negative levels, so one needs to go through the Kasdan-Lutzig technology to know exactly which nulls to subtract out. So, and again, the check matches. And finally, which will become more clear a little bit later on, the S-duality of my theory is nicely captured by the fact that the SO8 current algebra features triality. Some more results are the fact that the chiral algebra associated to n equals 4 super Young-Mills is a super W algebra with additional generators of dimension Casimir invariants, the degree of the Casimir invariants divided by 2. So there are exactly rank G additional generators, and their dimensions are given by this degree of Casimir invariants divided by 2. In particular, for SU2, one just finds the small n equals 4 super W algebra. And we moreover conjecture that any theory which has as its Higgs branch the one instanton moduli space of a certain flavor group, that corresponding chiral algebra is precisely the affine current algebra at a particular level. Yes.
Is there any hope to classify any of four super W algebras?
It's a hope. It's one of my bullets at the final slide. Can we characterize chiral algebras which come from four dimensions? And if they are characterized, can we classify them? So, we hope so, but there's no concrete progress yet. A particular example which will be useful in a couple of slides is the fact that the Minahan-Nemesradsky theory, which is also known as the T3 theory, has at its chiral algebra the E6 current algebra at level -3. So let me now move on to discussing chiral algebras of class S. So I told you that chiral algebras are independent of exactly marginal couplings, and theories of class S up to marginal couplings are exactly described by handing me a punctured Riemann surface of genus G with S punctures and a choice of simply laced Lie algebra G. So I will always choose G to be of the A type. So as soon as I hand you a punctured Riemann surface, I can construct a class S theory by doing the usual compactification from six dimensions. And given that theory, I can compute, in principle, the chiral algebra which is associated to it. So if I just cut out going through the four-dimensional theory, I can associate to any Riemann surface a chiral algebra. And I know that that chiral algebra will not depend on the complex structure moduli of the Riemann surface because, I told you, it doesn't depend on marginal couplings. So what I find is that class S theories give me a generalized topological quantum field theory that takes values in chiral algebras. So I can associate to any Riemann surface a chiral algebra. So this topological quantum field theory takes few ingredients. First, I need to know how to gauge different Riemann surfaces, which is, of course, implemented by the gauging procedure which I outlined earlier, this DRST cohomology computation. I also need to tell you what is the chiral algebra associated to a certain number of elementary building blocks, namely the cap, the cylinder, and the three-punctured sphere. And of course, they have to satisfy certain compatibility requirements, namely, for example, that if I glue the cap to a three-punctured sphere, I should end up with the cylinder. And moreover, a more interesting compatibility requirement is the one that is associated to associativity of the TQFT, and which descends from generalized S-duality in the mother four-dimensional theory. In fact, using exactly these associativity constraints, the Kayoto, Rastelli, and Razamat managed to completely fix the superconformal index once they were given the index of the free chiral multiplet. So the question here, of course, is, given that our chiral algebras are what I would call the categorification of the Schur index, by which I mean I assign to each number in the index a vector space, the question would be is if this associativity constraint is powerful enough to also completely fix the chiral algebras of class S. It's so far an open question, but for sure it's an interesting thing to think about. Yes?
So a lot of your chiral objects can be described as curved beta gamma systems on fixed mesh.
At one point we had this thought, but we have not explored it further.
But in this version, is there a similar description in terms of moduli bundles on the Riemann surface or
I don't know. I'll tell you how we describe the trinions, and then you can tell me if that fits with what you have in mind. So indeed, I want to describe the trinion theory, so the three punctured spheres. Now, of course, the T2 theory is a theory of free hypermultiplets, which we already know gives a chiral algebra described by symplectic bosons, with the OPE given over here. The T3 theory, I mentioned a couple slides ago, we conjecture to be the affine current algebra of E6 at level minus 3. And in fact, for this particular conjecture, we also performed the checks I listed before for the SU2 superconformal QCD, except, of course, the explicit cohomological construction, because there's no Lagrangian starting point. And for T with n larger than or equal to 4, we conjecture that the double algebra is generated by a stress tensor, of course, which has the relation to the four-dimensional C central charge of with a factor of minus 12. Each of the punctures carries an affine current algebra, which actually sits at the critical level, meaning that its level is minus its dual Coxeter number. And on top of these generators, we also conjecture that there should be generators associated to, of dimension a half L times n minus L for in representation anti-symmetric to the Lth power of SUn cubed. In fact, the reasoning behind this conjecture is quite simple. The stress tensor was clear already. The affine current algebras are just descending from the Flavour symmetry in four dimensions. And these additional generators are precisely the generators of the Higgs branch of these theories. So it's the absolutely minimal assumption we could make for the chiral algebra. And, well, the fact that such a double algebra exists or would exist is very non-trivial, because if I hand you any collection of generators, it's absolutely not guaranteed that I would be able to solve the Jacobi identities. It's not guaranteed that any set of generators allows me to solve a conformal bootstrap equation. But if I hand you the correct set of generators, then I will be able to solve the bootstrap program. And once I do so, I gain access to this infinite amount of spectral data about the four-dimensional theory, and also I get a handle on Higgs branch relations in the four-dimensional theory because they were exactly related to null relations in the chiral algebra. In fact, for T4, we showed that the set of generators I list over here is sufficient, and one can indeed write down general singular OPEs for these guys such that the Jacobi identities hold. So let me give a few more details about that. The T4 algebra, the conjecture I gave is more explicitly three current algebras associated to each of the punctures, stress tensor, a tri-fundamental field of dimension 3/2, a tri-antifundamental field of dimension 3/2 again, and a guy that transforms into 666 of SU4 cubed of dimension 2. So the absolutely simplest OPE I could write down, which is not completely fixed, is the one involving two W's. So I've written it over here, but I can guarantee you that in general, say, the OPE of two V's would not fit on the slide. It really gets big, but it's manageable, and being manageable, it's even better, it's solvable. So I can actually solve the Jacobi identities, fix all coefficients which appear, and once one does so, one can start computing chiral ring relations through the null relations of this chiral algebra. And here I give a particularly nice example of a null relation in 2D or a chiral ring relation in 4D, which I think was not quite known yet. Now, so far, I didn't really mention what happens if the punctures are not maximal, so let me quickly fill that gap. So partially closed punctures of a four-dimensional theory are labeled by embeddings of SU2 inside SUN, and the flavor symmetry they then carry is exactly the centralizer of the embedded SU2 inside SUN. Now, a particularly nice procedure purely in four-dimensional language to obtain from a maximal puncture a puncture with reduced flavor symmetry is one where one gives a Higgs branch F to the moment map operator. So I decide to give it a certain VEF, which assigns to the moment map operator the matrix which, well, the embedded SU2 lowering generator. And once I do that, of course, I break superconformal symmetry. I break certain flavor symmetries. But when I flow towards the infrared, superconformal symmetry will be restored. I throw out a certain amount of Goldstone modes. And what I'm left with is precisely a theory which has a reduced flavor symmetry puncture. Now the question, of course, is can I translate this particular procedure in my chiral algebra? And the very simplest thing one could try to do, except for giving a Higgs branch VEF, which would not make particularly much sense in two dimensions, is to impose constraints which would mimic this, this Higgs branch VEF story in four dimensions. So I decide to give a constraint. I constrain the affine current associated to the SU2 lowering operator, decide to set it to 1, and together with some additional constraints, this exactly is the input of a quantum dream thought circle of reduction. In fact, it's a more general setup because we have not just the current algebra, but also non-trivial modules of that current algebra in our chiral algebra. So we need to slightly extend the known quantum dream thought circle of reduction theory. So let me give a simple example of how that would go. I would like to reduce the four-punctured sphere of SU2 class S to a three-punctured sphere. So the four-punctured sphere, I told you, was just the SO8 current algebra at level minus 2. The three-punctured sphere is these three symplectic bosons. And the question is, can I reproduce this result by doing a quantum drift field circle of reduction, by closing this puncture completely? Closing a puncture completely in corresponds to the principal embedding of SU2 inside SUN, which, if I'm looking at an SU2 theory, is simply the identity. So after I rewrite my SO8 current algebra in a somewhat more natural language for the four-puncture sphere, namely as four current algebras together with a quadrifundamental field, then the constraint I would like to impose is simply that the lowering operator associated to this particular puncture is equal to 1. And actually, because SU2 is so simple, this is the only constraint that quantum Dreyfus Sokolov tells me to impose. So I would like to impose this constraint via a BRST procedure. I write down the BRST current, which involves introducing a ghost pair with the usual OPE. So B has dimension 1, C has dimension 0. It has the usual OPE. And I would like to solve this BRST cohomology problem to find the reduced theory. To solve the BRST problem, we can employ a spectral sequence argument, which, as I said, is an extension of the known arguments which are around for normal quantum dream field Sokolov of affine algebras. So what I do is I split this current into two pieces, namely, well, the C piece and a piece involving the current. These two pieces are such that if I add them up back, I get the original current. And moreover, their associated charges are nilpotent and they anti-commute with each other. So this is a well-defined double complex, and I can start solving it by a spectral sequence argument. I will not show you all the nitty-gritty details of the spectral sequence itself, but I will tell you that at the end of the day, you arrive at a set of generators, which now are calligraphic because they got mixed in with different stuff, of dimensions 2, 3 halves, 1, and 1 half. Now, the fact that these dimensions got modified is easily understood. Originally, they all had dimension 1, but I imposed a constraint which sets a dimension 1 object equal to a dimension 0 object. So that means that I must twist my stress tensor if I hope to preserve any conformal symmetry. So if I indeed do that twist of the stress tensor, then the dimensions turn out to be as given over here. Of course, this doesn't look particularly good if we hope to recover the free hypermultiple theory, because those were just trifundamental bosons. But a final step of this procedure is just to compute nulls. I compute nulls involving these generators, and I just try to figure out if any of these generators is redundant in the sense that it can be rewritten as a normal ordered product of derivative of some of the other guys. And indeed, I can find out that all these currents, where I is 2, 3, 4, this guy can all be written as normal ordered products of this dimension 1/2 guy, which is kind of nice because this guy, apart from having the right dimension to be a symplectic boson, it also satisfies the right OPE up to BRST exact stuff. So indeed, this is just one example of how the BRST procedure, or more generally, the quantum Ginfeld-Sokolov procedure reduces punctures. I must say here that we performed the same computation for the T3 theory, reducing it to obtain the free hypermultiplets. That worked out, and we consider it as an extra check of the conjecture that the T3 theory actually is the E6 current algebra at level minus 3. So there are two more ingredients of my topological quantum field theory which I have not specified yet. That is the cylinder and the cap theory. And, well, they don't correspond to actual four-dimensional theories. They are just required for the topological quantum field theory to be formally fully defined. So one can expect that they have somewhat funny behavior. And indeed, the conjecture we have in place for the cylinder is that it is generated by a current algebra, which is again of critical level, together with a collection of bifundamental dimension zero currents. These bifundamental dimension zero currents, they are acted on by this current algebra only from the left, and they satisfy a dimension zero relation that sets to one their determinant. Since I have some time, let me quickly explain how this cylinder might do the job which you expect it to do, namely, if you glue it into a theory, it should not modify your theory. But actually, I'm looking at the cylinder which bends back, so the only modification I should expect is that the flavor symmetry gets conjugated, since the orientation of the circle went back. So how we think that that works out is, if you glue it in, you're supposed to introduce the BC system, you're supposed to do the BRST cohomology. But as step one I explained, one should start by looking at gauge invariant states. Now, it is easy to construct gauge invariant states for every charged state in the original theory by simply contracting away all indices which are charged under the puncture which I'm gauging the cylinder to, by contracting all those guys with this dimension zero gadget. So then, since I said this current only acts on the left, the right index is completely free, and if I contract it in with every single index of my original operator, I will get a gauge invariant guy. And that gauge invariant guy, because exactly of this determinant condition, will have exactly the right OPEs to be the same as in the original theory up to this conjugation. We haven't quite figured out all the details, in particular because dimension zero objects are hard to deal with, but this is the general gist of how it should work out. So, no, you can write
G inverse the G.
Yes, so you can write a second current algebra. So the cylinder has two ends. This lives at one end, and the guy at the other end is indeed of the form G del G. Well, it's this current contracted with the G's plus a G del G.
But you can do G del G and del G G, right?
But that probably will turn out to be the same using, well, it's G del G inverse, right? And the G inverse is actually n minus 1 G's itself because of the determinant condition. And I think that the two will turn out to be equal as soon as you implement that it's equal to 1. And the cap chiral algebra is even more exotic because it actually features negative dimension fields. So I will honestly not talk too much about it. So let me conclude by mentioning some interesting future directions. So I presented to you unitarity bounds which were obtained by looking at the four-point function of twisted translated moment map operators in the 2D side and moment map operators in the 4D side. But of course, we can play the same game with any other correlator, and one would hope that that would lead to extra or new unitarity bounds. That's an interesting problem which one might want to tackle. The problem I already mentioned, it would be very interesting to characterize a chiral algebra that can possibly descend from four dimensions, in particular, for example, for the n equals 4 theories. And once one can characterize them completely, one can hope to classify them. And if you can classify the 2D children, one might hope to find some sort of classification of the 4D theories. It's an ambitious problem, but if it works, that would be a very nice result. A natural question one might ask is, what happens if I start including surface operators or any defect operators? For the particular case of surface operators, we think it just includes a vertex operator in the chiral algebra. Another question is the one I mentioned throughout the talk. Can the constraints from associativity be sufficiently powerful to completely fix chiral algebras of class S? I don't know the answer, but in the index, it did work. So given that chiral algebra is some kind of uplift of the index, it might actually work. Finally, for Lagrangian theories, one might wonder, are there any connections to localization, to holography? In particular, also for the non-Lagrangian theories, if one just wants to understand the gauging procedure, can one indeed deduce this slogan that 4D gauging is 2D gauging? And finally, a similar correspondence between a 3D superconformal theory and a 1D topological field theory should be possible. And in fact, we're working on that now.
Questions?
No more questions, let's thank Paul for again.